Just going to say one thing about our speaker before he gets up here. I'm going to set the record straight before he does. No, I'm going to tell you what kind of a human being this person is. In 1972, I guess it was, I was sort of working my way across the country, and I had known Bob since 1966 in AA, and we got to be close friends in, I think, 71 it was. And anyway, I sort of was bopping around the country doing various things and jobs and women and so on. And I was in Kansas City and I was nuts. And I wrote him a letter telling him that I was in such a state of being. And I just wrote him a letter saying I'm in Kansas City and, you know, and it's okay. And my writing was sort of all over the page, so he knew something was wrong. And there was no return address on the letter, which is the story. And about 2 days later, at 10 o'clock at night, there was a knock on the door, and I opened it, and there he was, and saying, you know, is there any place I can get a cup of coffee? And he came 1,500 miles to see a brother at Alcoholics Anonymous and also to visit a place that he wanted to visit for some time. But he found me in a city of about 750,000. I haven't asked him how he did it yet. I'd like to think it's spiritual, but... anyway, but that's how much he cares. And we can all get kind of lost in the conventions and the speakers and the big meetings. But Alcoholics Anonymous comes down to one drunk caring about another and going and talking with them and letting them know that it'll be okay. And walking through the troublesome times with him. And that's what he did for me. And he's done it for me a lot of other times. And I'm proud that he's my friend. I give you Bob E.
I am Bob Earl. I am a drug addict and alcoholic. Which one of these is which?
Hi, Bob.
That's the one I want. That's a nice story, God. Actually, it was so crazy what he had done is he had put the name of the street on the outside of the envelope, but not the address itself. And the house was easy to pick out. It was unique among all the others on the block. It looked like one where someone was living in a rather tense relationship. You could just feel it as you drove by, you know.
Everything's okay, you know. That kind of...
I don't know who brought me the cold can of tab, but God bless you. This is my one massive compulsion still left. I'm really glad to be here. I like this area a lot, and I like the people a lot. And it's a holiday time, which is always a nice time to share because people are usually loonier than a fucking moon. And the only thing that can stand between you and Christmas, a good Christmas, a happy Christmas, a joyous Christmas, is your head. Otherwise, you'll have a good Christmas, unless you decide to think. You know, plan, get ready, prepare. Depend upon, expect. Well, the money tree's gone, guys, you know what I mean? That's one solution, just went in the toilet. God, I feel really good tonight. It's funny, I haven't talked in a while. Maybe that's why I feel so good. I'm with friends, I guess that's important, who are going through things. I'm just thrilled to be here. I've been sober a long time. My sponsor says if I want, I can say I'm in my 20th year. I'm in my 20th year. So for those of you who are new, listen.
I was listening to the guy read the fifth chapter. You know, I thought it's interesting. Everything leading up to and including step one talks all about alcohol and alcoholism, and then it quits. And then the word isn't mentioned again. And there's probably a very definite reason for that. And I don't talk about my past and what it used to be like and what happened to me and the rest of that bullshit, because we all know basically what it's like out there, or we wouldn't be here. I noticed a lot of other people going into a lot of other doors other than this one when I was coming here tonight. Somebody said basketball and theater and, you know, a lot of things going on around here. It's full of people. See? And their past aren't similar to ours, which is why we're all here, because our past is all similar. You see? So there's no need to talk about that, because for me, the sobriety, the process of sobriety has been as painful as the process of the alcoholism and the addiction. More so in a lot of ways. The difference is the results. You see, the results of the pain and the agony of the drinking and the using were always more pain and more agony. The results of the pain and the agony of sobriety of working this program are always peace of mind and good feelings and a sense of well-being, you see. So I'm going through the same kind of a process. It's just that the results that I'm getting at either end of are a lot different. And I now have the power to choose between which kind of results do I want. Do I want to live a happy life, a fulfilled life? Do I want to be free and rich and, you know, just generally healthy and enjoy? Or do I want to, you know, be cool? Being cool was an interesting process in sobriety. It's tough. I have never spent so much time alone in my life as being cool. 300 people all standing around saying, "Let me help you." Ah, that's okay, man. That's cool. I was watching that. People get very nervous sometimes when they get to podiums and large meetings, or in small meetings, you know. And I watch that nervousness, you know. And the only thing I can think of nowadays when I see that nervousness is that our parents really taught us well. Worry about what they think. Don't make a mistake. You might show them you're human and fuck up, and then you're in trouble, you know. And it's sad when we spend our entire lives worrying about what the other people think. You know, there's a gal in Southern California, and she for years has said she was going to write her autobiography, and she was going to entitle it, "My Life is Seen Through the Eyes of Those Who Lived It." And I understand that. I identify with that because I find out over the years in sobriety that the least important person in my life is me. I spend a lot of time thinking about me. I spend a lot of time thinking about my situation. I spend a lot of time thinking about how you can either add to or detract from my situation. But I never am in touch with my life. It just seems to be going on past me while all this thinking is going on, you know. Someone once said, and it's really true, life is what's happening while you're busy making plans. So when you're sitting thinking, it's probably the biggest waste of time that you're going to spend in sobriety. I have spent thousands of hours thinking in sobriety. I speak from headaches and exhaustion, acid indigestion, pain, misery, and the results of the conclusions that I arrived at during all those long hours. Well, fuck 'em, I'll kill 'em. That's, you know. Alone by myself, I have a lot of trouble arriving at a rational, mature, well-adjusted adult solution to an existing situation in my life. I usually arrive at an irrational, insane, totally off the wall, immature, childish, screaming solution to the problem, which doesn't help. Because if you implement that, then three more people hate you. As you approach Christmas, you might want to think about the most important person in your entire holiday season is sitting in your chair. That's a bitch, isn't it? You're probably the last person you've given any thought to right now. And I'm sharing all this bad because it's me, right? I know how to put me last, okay? I know how to just totally ignore me. Now, I'll tell a little story because it best typifies what I'm trying to say. About a year ago, now almost, I don't know, maybe 6 months, I don't know when, it doesn't matter, it was sometime in the last 12 months, I was doing a lot of running. And in the process of this running, my body is somewhat crooked from practicing our disease on the streets and in the institutions for a lot of years. And you seem to get a few bones put out of place, and bullets shatter bones, and they don't quite grow back right, you know. And so my body isn't perfectly straight. It kind of goes like an S if you look at it on an X-ray. So running becomes a problem with that kind of a body because you have a tendency to wobble, you know, when you're not well balanced. But I was running and wobbling and reasonably happy. I was having some special shoes made that helped a little bit. But I kept getting blisters because I kept wearing different types of shoes for different types of surfaces. And finally some guy said to me, look, what you got to do is you got to get these inserts made for your shoes called orthotics. And then you can move them from one pair to the next pair to the next pair to the next pair, and all your shoes will be the same that way. And I said, Jesus, that's really a good idea. You know, I mean, that sounded wonderful. And he said, the guy that does this, the best in the country is in Long Beach. Okay? So make an appointment, go see him, and have him do it for you. I said, okay, great. Well, I thought about it. And I was living in Santa Monica at the time. And Long Beach is a long way from Santa Monica. Okay. Now, I would drive you to Long Beach to get orthotics for your shoes if you came to me and said, this guy said I ought to get these things for my shoes, and the guy that does them is in Long Beach. Could you take me? I'd say, yeah, I'll take you. Sure. See? I'll do it for you, but I won't do it for me. Huh? I got thinking about it. I figured, Skip, there's got to be a doctor closer. So I looked around and found Century City closed. Looked in the Yellow Pages. Found a doctor. Went. He said, nah, I don't do them, but I have a gal coming into practice with me in a month. She'll do them. Now, normally, I would know that the door was closed. Right? I mean, once you get going on a spiritual path around here, you'll learn something like that as a no. It doesn't mean come back next week or tomorrow or kick the fucking door down. It means no. Take another direction. Not lay more track. Right? We're great for laying more track. I don't care if there's a cliff there. I must go on. Don't bother me with the facts. I'm on a roll. So instead of seeing that as a closed door and a no, I just waited and kept wobbling for another month. Went, saw this gal, had the orthotics made. Finally, they came in the mail, stuck them in my shoes, went out and took a little 3-mile run, went home, sat down, went to get up a half hour later to go to the bathroom and couldn't walk. Right? I'm limping along, right? And I was hanging out with insane runners, those who run marathons, and they're into pain. That's like, Sash, stretch it out, you'll be okay. Run through it. That's the attitude, you know? That's the line. Run through it. I mean, hey, you know, I lived like that for a lot of years. Everybody goes, running through it, it's all right. You know. A little bad dope won't kill you. Just use it till the good stuff gets here. My self-worth hadn't improved one bit. So I was out wobbling up and down the pass, dragging a leg behind, looking not too good. Some of my friends began to notice, and they said, listen, what you need to do is you need to go to these guys in Pasadena. These guys in Pasadena are heavy into sports medicine. They treated the Olympic team. A couple of them are runners themselves. They'll have you back in shape like that. Now, that sounded good because the pain was starting to get to me now. But I had to think about it. If you think Long Beach is far from Santa Monica, Pasadena is further, you see? So I gave it a lot of thought. I decided, to hell with it, I'd go to the marina. It's close. I went to the marina to a chiropractor who was about 50 pounds overweight. When I mentioned running, his eyes just kind of glazed over. Yeah. I didn't think he knew what the word meant. And he'd keep trying to put me in place, and I'd keep going out running and coming back, you know, limping and dragging again. I put myself through all this, and I can't think, there's not one of my close friends that I would not have driven to both Long Beach and Pasadena. See, but I wouldn't take me. I wouldn't take me. Finally, eventually, I went to Pasadena. And finally, eventually, I went to Long Beach and saw the appropriate doctors, okay? And pretty soon I'll be back running again. But the sad thing about all that is that 18 years sober, I couldn't take myself to the best possible help available. I didn't think enough of me to take me there. Second best was okay, see. I had been well raised. I can remember being 2 years old with shoes that were too small because they were special shoes and they were expensive. So they didn't buy them very often. All right? And you can walk around saying, well, what has that got to do with anything? I'll tell you something, man. If you're not worth buying shoes for that fit, you don't get a hell of a lot of sense of self-worth. Okay? I am convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt, and this is my opinion only. If you're new, everything I say is my opinion. And they'll change, some of them, probably before I get back to the hotel. They do that the longer you're around. Leave the podium and say, I don't know if I agree with that or not. 12 other people will stay awake all night. Hey, and I've already decided it was a bad idea. But I am convinced that lack of self-esteem is the number one problem in sobriety. I don't care enough about me to do anything for me, and this is a personal program of recovery. It is a personal... Why apply the steps to my life if I'm not worth it? Okay? Why work this program? You know? How many people do you know work the program? Have you got dust on your big book? Huh? You haven't taken it out and read it, man? Applied a step to your life? Why not? Why not? You've gone to meetings and people have stood up at those meetings and they have said, I've been working these steps and I feel good and my life has taken changes and things are happening and there is abundance in my life and there's a creative energy in my life and I feel really good. And they walk away and you get a sense from them and you know they mean it, man. Something's happening in their life. You can just feel it. And you'll go home and turn on the television. I'll get to the book later. The big book is for those important times when you're 3 deep breaths away from suicide. I read it now. I have a little problem going here. I want to die. I don't want to drink. I just want to die. And we can't even do that well because we want to die with reservations, you know. I may want to come back next week. I like to just go for a little while. You know. Wait till the smoke clears. Throughout my sobriety, I have continually talked myself into bad situations and out of good ones. With no help from anybody. I have learned to use a magic rule in my life. If my head is for it, if my head is supportive of it, if my mind is 100% behind it, I don't go. And if my mind is opposed to it and screams and yells and says, no, it's terrible, you can't go, they'll make fools of you, don't do it, I go. Somehow it's always okay. So I had to learn that my mind had turned me, because of my opinion of myself, it turned me into a non-functioning human being in sobriety, which in essence very simply means there were mornings I didn't get out of bed. Okay? I had places to go, people to see, things to do, and couldn't get out from underneath the covers. 2-3 years sobriety, forget it. Didn't matter who called. I could have talked to God, and I was not getting out of bed.
Yeah?
My mind had refused to leave the house. I didn't know what was out there. Didn't care. Didn't want to find out. It was it. This is it. I had a routine. The alarm goes off, you shut it off, and you lay there in bed with your head still on the pillow, with the covers still to your chin, as long as you can stand it. And then when the guilt gets too great, and more daylight begins to come in, you stay on the pillow, but you pull the covers up over your head. And as more of the day begins to come in, and more of the guilt begins to come in, you start working your way towards the foot of the bed. I've had to learn to live, to break all of this wonderful habit. I have had to learn how to do it anyway. Okay? I've had to learn how to show up. The two most important words in my life are show up. Man, nothing can hurt me if I just show up. Because I'm used to not showing up. First I've got to learn how to show up, and then I've got to learn how to be present when I get there. These are two distinct phases of recovery. One has nothing to do with the other. Physical presence doesn't mean you're there. But I had to learn, even though I could lay in bed. Now, in the mornings, my mind always attacked me in the mornings. Okay? It's like... It's not. It's like it did. I would wake up and it's as if this mind of mine was perched on the headboard, like a vulture on a cactus plant in the desert. And it would say, "Ah, good, you're awake. I have been waiting. There are a few things I'd like to discuss with you. And if you say, what are they, you're in trouble." Because the first thing it will tell you is that you're too tired. You're too tired. You can't get up. You didn't get enough sleep. You're worn out. Today is going to be a long day. Forget it. They've all been 24 hours for a long time, right? There isn't one longer than the other, but my mind loves that phrase. Jesus, today is going to be a really long one. Anything it can do to overwhelm me. Loves to see me overwhelmed, going, "God, no, no more," you know. I haven't moved, nothing has happened, and I'm already, "No, no more," you know. Then it always puts you in a dilemma, right? It'll say to you, "Well, if you go to work as tired as you are, you're going to get fired. And if you don't go, you're going to get fired." And you say, "Oh, Jesus, I got to go anyway. I got to get out of bed. I got to go." And you throw one foot out of bed. And as you throw the foot out of bed, you'll get a little pain in your knee. And the mind will say, "Uh-huh, that's it, the big C." Feel that pain in the joints? Bone cancer. You're going to die in about 3 months. And you probably, because you've lost your job, won't have enough money to take care of the treatment you're going to need, so you're going to be broke and dying and out of work. So here you are, 12 seconds awake, unemployed, poverty-ridden, and dying. And people wonder why the alcoholic doesn't leap up to greet the day, right? That's because we know what's out there. We were taught by our parents what to expect. Don't enjoy that. Don't get too happy. It will be taken away from you. But it's always been taken away from me. I've had to learn that even though I'm broke, unemployed, and dying, I get up and show up in the bathroom in front of the mirror and shave anyway. It's just called faking it. I'm on my way out, I want to go looking good. Then you show up in the shower. After you've showered, you show up at the closet. Pick out something to wear, which on these kind of mornings can really be a fucking chore. You can change shirts or blouses or whatever so many times, man, that you've already wiped out your deodorant, you know. Perspiration's dripping. God, I can't make up my mind, you know. Once you've gotten through all that, you try and show up at the car with the keys in hand. You point it in the general direction to where you work and leave. If you don't think your mind has control of you, what is today, Saturday? Monday, take a different route to work. Listen to the silence. Yes? The minds have gone into shock. They're giving you reasons why you can't take a different route to work. No, let's not get into that crap. That's ridiculous. We barely get there as it is, you know. I mean, if we take 17 and then by the shit, the railroad tracks, you could get stuck by a train at that signal. You can't get off the freeway there. You can't make a left turn. We can't do that. I'll go the old way. Do you know why your mind likes the old way? Because you've got it down so pat that it can spend the entire time from the time you leave the house until you arrive there thinking. Getting you ready for the day. And my mind never gets me ready for the day looking forward to nothing good, man. It's like it's always bad. It's always bleak. Oh, I know the boss is going to be in a bad mood and things are going to have gone wrong and I probably lost a negative in the lab and I'm not driving. It's like having a car full of children, you know. Nobody wants to go where the driver, you know, right? It's like, I used to try and explain to people it was a miracle that I came through the gate in the morning. Right? Anything I did for the rest of the day was bullshit. The fact I got through the gate was a miracle. Okay? Try it. I'm serious. Take a different route. Take away the power of this thing. My mind has caused me more goddamn grief in this program. It's like, the hardest thing has been for me to do is to learn to care about me. To learn to love me. Okay? I know how to take rejection. I expect it. If I don't get it, I will make it happen. Don't you dare be nice and try and be intimate with me. I'll get you, you know. Because I don't know what any of that is like, see, because I never got any of that as I was a child. I'm one of these people who arrived today with 15 years of their life a total blank, absolute complete blank. Couldn't remember anything from my childhood. And I guess I had a lot of sponsors who had the same problem because I read all my inventories to all these sponsors over a ton of years and they all started at 15 years of age and nobody said anything. Alright? And about 2.5 years ago in a screaming match with a lady, it was pointed out to me that I'd been married 5 times and possibly it wasn't them. In all honesty, that thought had never entered my mind. It had never, ever entered my mind. It had always been okay. I never, never thought anything other than it was them. You know. I always thought my attitudes about women were good. A little oriental, perhaps, but... basically good. The truth will out. I feel like saying there was one point. I don't want to tell this, but I will. The only thing that keeps me okay is just giving up all the things I don't want to give up. There's one point in therapy where I made a really big discovery and I went home and I fully intended to send a postcard to every lady I'd been involved with in sobriety saying, if you're still holding a resentment, thank my mother. Because she's the one I was after. Anyway. I gave some consideration to what this lady had said to me and thought, you know what? Maybe she's right. Maybe she's right. I'm in a lot of pain. I'm in a lot of, there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anguish. I have done the best job I know how to do with the tools presented to me by Alcoholics Anonymous. I am 17 years sober. I have written 30 inventories. I have gone through sponsors. I have driven hundreds of thousands of miles. I have talked thousands of times. I have participated. I've had, you know, done, if it was here to do, I did it. And I couldn't think of anybody I could talk to who could help me take my life one step further. So somebody suggested, why don't you consider therapy? I said, okay, at this point, anything. And as long as you have had a long history of problems with women, maybe you should consider a woman. It's amazing the shit you'll put yourself through when you're vulnerable. You know what I mean? I'm kidding. It's more fun being strong. Go to men's stag. A lot of strong men's stags. They don't belong to AA, of course, but they're... Oh, I don't even want to get into that one. That one's so tiresome. So anyhow, I went to check out this therapist. And a lot of people get upset when you talk about therapy in AA. And I don't know why. It's in the book. It says it's okay. And I'm starting to find out the only people who get upset are the people who really don't want to know anymore. They don't want to find any more out. The last thing, the biggest thing you're afraid of is learning more about you. Because that's the biggest thing I was afraid of. I didn't want to find any more out about me. I already knew how rotten I was. I already knew how no good I was. I already knew how bad my thinking was. I used to sit in meetings, man. My thinking the first 5 years I was sober was absolutely horrible. I never listened to a speaker that I didn't think about killing or raping. Just, you know, I mean, there was never any peace, man. It was relentless, absolutely relentless. It was just like, there was no quiet time. I was judging and condemning and critical and crazy and insane, and the mind just went on and on. So I don't want to get to know any more about me. I know enough about me. I'm a bad boy. I'm lucky to be alive. I don't deserve the things I have. They could be taken away from me at any moment because I don't deserve them. So I went to check out therapy, and I went to see this gal, and we sat down at this original interview. And she said, tell me a little bit about yourself, starting with your childhood. And I said, okay. When I was 15, they threw me out of Manual Arts High School. I looked around, and the only thing to do was to deal dope. And I spent the next 11 years of my life in and out of institutions dealing narcotics and basically getting shot up. And I went to AA when I was 26, and I've been clean and sober 17 years. She has this rather strange expression on her face and said, I said, your childhood. I mean, you didn't start at 15. You didn't arrive here at 15. And I sat there dumbfounded. Because as far as I was concerned, I had arrived at 15. I might as well have been born at 15. I didn't know anything before 15. And she said, tell me about prior to that. When you were 2, 3, 4, 5, 8, 9, 12. Well, I can't remember. And can just see that marvelous expression again on their faces, like, oh, God, right? I can do a paper on this one. This one sticks with it. I'll be famous. Probably bored is more like it. So we began a long process of trying to rumble back into little Bobby's past to see what the hell went on. And I share what I found because it's changed my life, and I've been told to share what the hell you're supposed to share. And one of the big things I've discovered is, A, my childhood, for one reason I can't remember any of it, is it was rotten. Okay? Now that I'm back into it, looking at it, feeling it, experiencing it, it wasn't all that great. First of all, I was raised in a house of silence. No one talked. I was the only child. Not wanted. My mother says she wanted me, but I'm not sure. My father has just said, no, fuck, you know. There's never any doubt in that area of here that I was not wanted, you know. We had no conversations. We didn't go anywhere together. We didn't do anything together. I mean, my old man never took a baseball mitt and came downstairs and tossed nothing in his life. He went to work, came home, drank, and went to bed. That was the entirety of his existence. That's all he did. So, I learned very early on that if you don't have extreme emotions, you're a good kid. If you don't get too happy or too sad, you're okay. See? As long as you don't go off of this middle line of emotional behavior that has been drawn by them. So I was quiet. Always quiet. I was 4 years old. I was in my first fist fight in Cheeseman Park in Denver, Colorado with a six-year-old who punched my lights out. But nobody ever bothered to ask, why is this cute little boy, man, with the curly hair and the sailor suit so mad? How does a four-year-old get that angry that early that he wants to fight? That he has to fight? Because at home, man, it was quiet. You know, I'm good. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. I'm not making any noise. Everything's cool. You know, I like to bite you both on the ankle, but everything's cool. You know. I don't want to let you know that somebody said something today in school that crushed me. Didn't do anything to me. I'm okay. I don't want to let you know that I watched a little puppy dog run down by a car today, man. Everybody's trying to be hip and fucking cool on the corner. Yeah, look at that, man. Flattered pancake. Oh, you know. I wanted to cry, but I don't want to tell anybody that I wanted to cry. I just wanted to stand there and say, oh, God, poor little dog. Poor little dog. I had to be cool and quiet. That's how you learn how to be cool, man. Learn how to be quiet at home. You know, be a good child. Don't make waves. I learned not to make waves. And I got to tell you something, if you don't know it already, not making waves is not emotionally healthy. Emotionally healthy people make waves. And if they have emotional healthy people in their lives with them, the waves don't do anything. Oh, geez, she's a little rough today, Margo. Have a good day. See you later. Out the door you go. Man, it's no big goddamn deal, you know, because the people don't have the power. It's like to walk around and say that you don't get sad, you don't get happy, you don't get angry. You know, I finally went, after about a year of therapy, I went to my therapist and I said, God damn it! I'm tired! You know? When do we quit this shit? Every day it's like I'm sad, I'm happy, I cry, I laugh. I'm not used to any of this. I've been cool for 40 goddamn years, you know? Suddenly I'm driving down the street and I cry. Shit, you know. I'd see a 1957 Chevy, you know, and it would bring back memories and I'd feel something. I would remember the date and the girl or the bust or the bullet holes or something, but I'd feel something and fear would go through me or pain or sadness and I'd go, God! I went back to this broad. I said, can't therapy be like a car wash? You know, so can't I just kind of just drive through quickly, get hit in the ass with a few brushes, a little soap in the eyes, and come out the other side? And, you know. Hidden all these feelings. She said, I must be something wrong with me. She said, no. That's just about what a day of life is like. It's nice to have you here. And I looked at her for a minute, and I thought, it's nice to be here. Honest to God, it's nice to be here. It's nice to know that I can get really sad over things. It's nice to know that my feelings can be hurt. It's nice to know that I can get really angry at something. I mean, I don't have to take a sales clerk by the throat, you know, but I can express my dissatisfaction. Say, I really think you're handling this badly, you know. Instead of not saying a word, being a good little boy, and being quiet, and seven blocks later, somebody cuts you off. Yeah, motherfucker, I'm going to kill you! Right? You know, the guy's like, Jesus, what did I do, man? You know. I'm small, you know. Christ, small error, you know. I've got
pieces of steering wheel in my hand, you know. All because they didn't tell some broad she overcharged me 33 cents, you know. I remember... a buddy of mine, he's sober as long as... We're sober the same like that. He used to tell his story, I love it. He went to, this is an example of what we all do to ourselves. He used to go to the gas station about 4 blocks from his house, and he'd pull it, he'd say, pull it up, do the windows, take care of everything, right? And the guy would fill it up, and he'd check the oil, and he always did the world's worst job of washing the windows, right? He'd squirt the thing twice, hit it with a dirty rag, and there'd be like grease streaks across the windshield, right? And Jim would give him his credit card and pay for his gas and leave. And he'd drive all the way home thinking how he's going to kill this guy one of these days, right? He was going to come at night, man, and he was going to set fire to his gas pumps and blow his goddamn gas station all over the valley. You know, I mean, it was like, it just would, he'd lay awake at night, you know, but he'd go back 3 days later, right? I mean, this is us, right? Why go to a good gas station where they do it right, where you can really, you know, do it to yourself? And he'd say to the guy, you know, fill it up and do the windows and things. And the guy would fill it up, check the oil, man. Same routine, streaks and dirt on the windshield, right? And he would go home. I mean, he would lay awake. And this went on for 3 months. 3 months. Once or twice a week. Losing sleep, acid indigestion, laying awake at night, planning 100 ways to end this guy's life and destroy his business, right? Finally, out of sheer desperation, he pulled in the gas station, and the guy did his gas, did his oil, and did the same rotten job on his windshield. And Jim said to him, you didn't do that very good. Could you do that over? Oh, yeah, sure. I do a lousy job. I'll be glad to do it over. Why didn't he say something to him in the first place? He's like I am, but he didn't want to make him mad. I found out that for the most part, I relate to the entire goddamn world as if they were my parents. Right? Even if it's a guy pumping gas, for Christ's sakes. So that's Dad. I want everything cool here. We don't have any problems, you know. Some old lady in Saks Fifth Avenue gives me a ton of shit, and I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, you know. I'm paying the money, for Christ's sakes, you know. I'm the one buying the goddamn merchandise, and I'm being talked to like a dog. I'm going to be a good little boy. Walk out of the store and then tear some poor son of a bitch's head off at work, right? What do you mean the Xerox machine doesn't work? Call him!
Boy, he gets excitable, doesn't he?
I had to learn that I had made one small error in all the inventories I had done in sobriety. One error was this, for me. I had said, oh yeah, Mom and Dad, Jesus, what am I going to do about them? And I wrote about Mom and Dad what I could remember from 15 on. And I had decided, well, okay, they did the best job they could with the tools they had at hand. They passed on to me what was passed on to them. Their mothers and fathers treated them as rotten as they treated me. Therefore, I forgive them, I love them, everything is okay. Crumple up the inventory, throw it away, and I'm done with that. Let us go on with life. And I didn't get any problem over that, or I didn't get any argument over that from anybody else, because everybody else was doing the same goddamn thing. Yeah, well, you know, sure, yeah. My old man beat me a few times. Dad took me to the hospital a couple of times. And, I remember when my mother stabbed me and they took her away. But, you know, it's okay. She did the best job she could, and I understand. And I'm not exaggerating, man. I'm really not exaggerating. So once some of us started getting into this stuff down south, man, we began to discover the alcoholics have got some interesting childhoods. Not quite as sane, rational, and normal as one might think. Okay? So I just kept going along with his attitude. Well, they did the best job they could with the tools they had, and God bless them, and I forgive them. Okay? And I almost died behind that one. And the reason I almost died behind that one is because there's two parts to that. Okay? There's two parts to that. First part is, yeah, because I have a terrible time with my mother, even today. I mean, you know, it's like, I'll go the day after Christmas and spend that day, and I will want to strangle the sweet, gray-headed little old lady at some point from the time I arrive until the time I leave. It will be all I can do to keep from just going, you know, but I'll smile sweetly and say, oh, hi, Mom. So I said, okay, she did the best job she could. She had the same bullshit put on her that was put on me. She passed every bit of misinformation, every lie, every wrong emotional judgment ever made in the history of mankind on to me, just like her parents passed it on to her. And my father passed on the alcoholism to me that his father passed on to him. You know? And all of the thinking and the insanity and the bullshit that goes with it. Okay? They did the best job they could. I forgive them. Part one. Part two. They may have done the best job they could do, but the reality is, it was a lousy fucking job. My parents should have not had a dog, much less a child. In fact, my parents had enough sense to not have a dog. We never had a pet. They knew they couldn't handle a dog, so they had a kid instead. And when you start looking back at some of this stuff in sobriety, it's not a lot of fun. It hurts like a son of a bitch. Because for some reason, boy, how did I get in here?
Well, what the hell?
For some reason, there is in us this child, in every one of us, and it seems like the most important goddamn thing in the world is that mommy loves me and daddy gives me his approval. And my father says, hey, you're a fine boy. And mommy says, come sit in my lap and let me love you. This is the things that we never got, or at least a lot, most of the people I know, all the people I know that I talk to in AA never got from their parents. And as a result, we lived our whole goddamn lives trying to make up for all this bullshit. If you wonder why we have so much trouble with relationships, stop to consider the fact that you girls, right, couldn't get daddy's approval, and we're fucking going to pay for that one, right? And all of us strong, cool, collected, wise, worldly, sophisticated, macho men are looking for mommy, for Christ's sakes. And when you're looking to get even and we're looking for mom, you can't have a hell of a relationship there, you know? A lot of problems arise at the first sign of trouble. What do you mean, help you? You're here to help me, for Christ's sake. Now give me that bullshit. Call your sponsor. That's because if you're like I am, you're always looking for something out there to fix it. That's why I had so much resistance to the steps. They are internal. I don't like internal things. I want that car that's going to fix it, or I want her. If I can just find her, she'll make everything okay. I walked in one day to talk to my therapist, and I had my teeth gritted. I said, I am so goddamn sick of driving down the street, man, like my head is like, you know, on some kind of ball bearings whipping from side to side, checking out every bride and every, you know, if it even looks like it might be a girl, you know, it's like, you know. Till I have this terrible pain between my shoulders, my neck is stiff, everything hurts, you know, I'm like this, man. I'm not going to talk to him. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just crazed, you know. And she smiles at me and she says, not terribly unusual behavior for a small boy lost in a department store looking for his mother. Didn't want to hear that, man. Didn't want to hear that. And that wasn't a freebie out of a sponsor either. I paid for that shit, right? We were talking one day, and I said to her, I said, you know, I can sense this other person inside of me, and I really like him. He's a very beautiful person. He's gentle and he's kind. And he's a soft person. And there's just something about him that feels good. I can just like see him. I said, but God damn it, he's so old. He's old. It's almost like he has gray hair, white hair, but he's an easy person and a gentle person. But he's so old. She said, maybe that's because he's an adult.
I said, oh, Jesus, no. Are you insinuating that I behave like an adolescent? She says, let us look at your capacity for commitment. I said, no, let us not. We'll get to that one at another time. So what have I discovered? I've discovered that I've spent most of my life sober in Alcoholics Anonymous relating to the vast majority of AA and the vast majority of our society as a whole as if they're enemies. I'm afraid of them. I'm afraid that they will accept me and I'm afraid that they will reject me. I'm afraid that you might get to know me better than I know me. And I hate the thought of that. I'm afraid that you might predict my behavior. That you might be there with something I need when I really need it because you knew that I was going to need it. And that's scary as hell. That means you have power. You have control. You really don't. That's what this says. Control, yes. I love the line that AAs don't have relationships. They just take hostages. There is a small amount of need for control in me. I don't know about you. I don't even want to get on control, man. Let me tell you. Control is... as long as you do what I want, when I want you to do it, we'll get along fine. Other than that, it's goodbye, man. It's like I can't be spontaneous because my mind does not want to be spontaneous because it can't stand surprises. And the reason my mind can't stand surprises is it spends all of its time getting ready. I spend every waking moment being prepared, you know. That's why it won't take a different route to work. Because it doesn't want any goddamn surprises. Yeah, sure, I'll trust God. Of course I trust God. Sort of. Are you willing to let go of absolutely everything and say, I am yours, take me and do with me as thou wilt? Don't be silly. I'm willing to drop on my knees in total pain and agony in the middle of the living room when I can't go one more step and say, look, if you fix this one, I'll give some consideration to turning my will and my life over. And the thing that I have always found unique or interesting about us and our relationship with God or about me with my relationship with God is I am the kind of compulsive, addictive, obsessive personality. When I hit on a combination of chemicals that really got me off, I would do everything in my power to remix the same combination. I mean to the point of appearing like Dr. Frankenstein, man, with test tubes, trying to powder everything and blend it and mix it and, you know, get it in a dropper and just get it down to that one combination that worked because it felt so good. Yet in sobriety, my back will be against the wall. I'll be totally goddamn insane in more emotional pain than I've ever been in my life. I can see no way out of my problem. Absolutely no way. I am finished. My life is going to crumble around me. I know it. And in absolute desperation, I say, oh, goddamn, it's yours. Fix it. And it gets fixed. Okay? It works. And 2 days later, a small problem will crop up. And one little voice inside him will say, surrender. And another one will say, no, 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 we'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. Why? When God works so wonderfully well in our lives. For me, it's been a simple thing. Lack of self-esteem. If I am no good, how can God possibly love me? Simple. I understand that. Logical to me. Isn't it logical to you? God loves the good guys. Ask them. The good guys will tell you.
My mama used to tell me,
be a good little boy, or God will punish you.
I don't know about you, man, but I brought that belief into Alcoholics Anonymous with me. And I would listen to people in AA meetings say, surrender, turn it over, it's going to be okay. I go home and say, yeah, God, I got to let it go. It's killing me. I know I got to let it go. And that's the worst place to be in. You know, I mean, one of the things you're going to learn around here in sponsoring people is, as long as they don't know it's necessary to let go, it doesn't matter how much bullshit's going on because it's not giving them any pain yet. I'll tell you it is, but it's really not. The pain comes when you know you got to let it go and you can't. You know, I gotta go home
and give it to God. I got to go home and give it to God. And you go home and you walk in the house and you kneel down and you say, oh dear, oh, forget it.
I can't let it go. Why not? What the hell are you afraid of? I was as afraid that it would work as I was that it wouldn't work. Scared me to death that it would work. That there really is a God. That He really has power. That He can alter my life. My life. That there is something going on. Because if there is, I'm not going to get it. It won't be for me because I am one of the bad guys. And if I'm one of the bad guys, and I don't want to know about nothing. See, I've done this to myself all my life. I diminish anything that might be important to me so I won't have to feel any pain when it's taken away. I have lived my whole life that way. It was pointed out to me that if things are important to me, I always call them shit. I mean, you may not particularly like the word, and I don't particularly like the word, which is why I say that. I would say to somebody, oh, yeah, well, yeah, yeah, you know, I've written 3 or 4 scripts and some of that shit. Dismiss it. It's not important. Don't make it important because it might be taken away from me. And I was unable to make God important because He might be taken away from me. Whew. Boy, I'm grateful He works His own program. Surrendering for me was difficult. I did it out of pain. Most positive things I have done up until recently, all positive things I have done for myself up until recently in sobriety have been out of pain. Only out of pain. I have been unable to take a positive action in my life because it is a positive action and I deserve that kind of behavior. Okay? My mind just took over. We'll be with you in a moment.
Tell that story. No, tell that one. No. Quit. You're tired. Fuck it. Go home.
No, stay. Finish.
That's why we think days are long, you know. Other people, have you ever watched the guys out there, a lot of them, they just do show up. The average guys, you ever watch some of the people you work with? They come in the morning, pleasant. Hi! How are you? Nice day. What do you mean, nice day? But I never ask them what they mean by that, you know. They're grateful for health. They're grateful that they have a place to come to. They're grateful for the money that they're earning from being there. They're in a good place, right? How would I sum up 19 years and 3 months of sobriety? Interesting, very interesting. That's also a word I use when I don't want to get in touch with emotion. Somebody said, well, I hear you went through 6 furnaces, 2 fires, a skydive, and a plane you were in crashed. How was it? Very interesting. Very interesting. And I never want to get in touch with the feelings. I wish I had 9 hours to talk about getting in touch with feelings. Somebody said that alcoholism could be called Stuffed Feelings Anonymous. Because as I listen to people's stories now, I realize that from the, our various earliest
ages, basically what we were trying to do was stuff the feelings. I've listened to stories about people who escaped through reading when they were children, and little girls escaped with their dolls, and guys escaped into athletics, or into reading, or into model airplanes, or into something. But somehow, compulsively, we did anything to escape the feelings, and then one day somebody said, "Here, take this." And you said, "God, the feelings are gone. And I'm okay. I'm okay." And spent the rest of your life trying to keep them down. Yeah, I know. I used to have a lot of trouble with Christmas and sobriety. Because I had a couple of daughters, and I had signed them over for adoption. One of them was born here in San Jose. And so my mind would come and get me every Christmas about all the things I was unable to do because I didn't have any money. You know? Or you should take them big presents. You should send them something. You should send telegrams and toys, and you should let them know you care, but you don't have any money and you can't do that, and you're a rotten father. And that's why you don't have them. And one day one of my sponsors said to me, "Why don't you remember that it was the carpenter's birthday and get out of all the present bullshit?" And I said, "My God, it's the carpenter's birthday." And I really want to share something with you, man. If you're having trouble with Christmas, remember what it's all about. Remember that it's the carpenter's birthday. It's a trip. That got me through more than one sober Christmas broke. Just celebrating the birthday of somebody that seemed to know what it was about. Right? Somebody that seemed to know what it was about. I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm slowly becoming grateful to be an addict and an alcoholic. It's taken 19 years. So if you're not thrilled with your situation, relax. I used to die. I used to sit in a meeting 15 years sober, and some guy would get up and say, "I am grateful that I'm an alcoholic." And I could, 15 years, I could still sit there and say, "Mm-mm. Not me. Not me. I'm not glad. Go through all this bullshit. I could be like the putz next door, man, the son of a bitch, just kind of grew up, went to college, got married, had two kids, still with the same broad, same job, he's happy, here I am. Pain. Emotion and feeling. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm grateful to have a chance to be participant in my life. I'm grateful to be here with Tommy. I got to tell a story about him. He told a story about me. It's not good that people think that friendships are one-sided, because they're not. It's always a two-way street. A year later, in 1973, after I had zoomed into Kansas to see him in 1972, I had just gotten married to a lady that I loved very much, and it appeared as the world was our oyster. We had bought a lovely home in the hills in Laguna Beach, and everything was going 100%. And she wasn't feeling well, and we took her to the doctor to be examined, and they told her she had cancer and she was going to die within a few months, and there was nothing they could do about it. And we were getting ready to leave the house one day to go back to Kansas City to spend some time with the ministers in Unity Village, because that's where she wanted to be. And we were trying to figure out what the hell we were going to do with the house, and she was worried about all her plants, because she figured the plants would die if we were gone too long and there was nobody to water them. And so this guy calls me from the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach. He just arrived in California. He had completed his travel from New York to finally had arrived and needed a place to stay. So he and his then lady came up and stayed at the house, and we went back to Kansas. And we stayed there a week or 10 days or however long, and we came back home. And this lady had decided to embark upon some non-toxic treatments for cancer, where the treatment wouldn't kill her. And some of them were rather bizarre or painful. And one of the ones was a purge, where you had to drink like Epsom salts for 3 days solid, 6 or 8 times a day. Theory being you're really totally going to flush your system. For no other reason other than he was a friend who cared and was in a situation that he had never been in before. This guy sitting here at the table said to her, "Look, you should not have to do this alone, and you should not go through that alone, so I will drink the Epsom salts with you for 3 days." And so for the entire time that she went through this one process, he went through every bit of it with her. What she had to drink, he drank. What she went for the vomiting and she did, he did. Everything that happened, every beat that took place, he participated in. So I guess it always does come back to this. Just what one of us can do when we're sitting quietly alone to share for another one. That kind of behavior is not in his personality. That is the kind of behavior of flying 1,500 miles because somebody wrote me a screwball letter crooked on the paper. It's in mine. Until we get past this wall that we have built to protect ourselves from ourselves. And now that I'm behind the wall, I will discount everything I just said. That type of behavior is an integral part of Tommy's personality, to care that deeply. That type of behavior, to care that deeply, is an integral part of my personality. I love him enough to do it for him, and he loves me enough to do it for me. We're really good people, guys. We're really very good people. Down inside of you and down inside me is the single most beautiful goddamn human being you have ever met in your life. The most important person this holiday season, I'm saying it again, man, is sitting in your chair. In your chair. You're not bad. You're not rotten. You're not no good. You're not bright. You're not attractive. You are really a very beautiful goddamn person. There is an absolutely beautiful fucking human being sitting in your chair. Take care of him. Give that person the best you can give him. Drive him to the best doctor. Buy that person something nice to wear. Buy yourself a Christmas present. Buy the little child that lives inside of you a goddamn toy. It's okay. It's really okay. Just think for one second. Don't let your mind take you away. You are a beautiful person, man. A beautiful person. We're all okay. Despite everything that anybody's ever told us, we're really okay. And I am thrilled to death that I am one of you. God bless you.
Thank you.